This month, we consider the spiritual practice of creativity. Let us light our chalice this morning in honor of the spark of creativity that dwells within each one of us. May we respond when we hear its call, do when the Spirit says do, sing when the Spirit says sing. Individually and together, may we use our creative powers to bring more light and more love to this world we share. So may it be. If there are any young people out there in the chairs who would like to come forward to the quilts for the kids' message, you may do so now. Come on forward. Feel free to bring a grown-up with you. And if you are new, you're welcome to bring your grown-up with you after the kids' message so they can settle you into your program and then come back. You're already up here. Today's story is The Dot by Peter Reynolds. Ready? Here we go. Art class was over, but Vashti sat glued to her chair. Her paper was empty. Vashti's teacher leaned over the blank paper. "Ah," she said, "a polar bear in a snowstorm." "Very funny," said Vashti. "I just can't draw." Her teacher smiled. "Just make a mark and see where it takes you." Vashti grabbed a marker and gave the paper a good, strong stab. "There!" Her teacher picked up the paper and studied it carefully. She pushed the paper toward Vashti and quietly said, "Now sign it." Vashti thought for a moment, "Well, maybe I can't draw, but I can sign my name." The next week, when Vashti walked into art class, she was surprised to see what was hanging above her teacher's desk. It was the little dot she had drawn, her dot, all framed in swirly gold. "I can make a better dot than that." She opened her never-before-used set of watercolors and set to work. Vashti painted and painted. A yellow dot, a green dot, a red dot, a blue dot. The blue mixed with the yellow. She discovered that she could make a green dot. Vashti kept experimenting. Lots of little dots in many colors. "If I can make little dots, I can make big dots, too." Vashti splashed her colors with a bigger brush on bigger paper to make bigger dots. Vashti even made a dot by not painting a dot. At the school art show a few weeks later, Vashti's many dots made quite a splash. Vashti noticed a little boy gazing up at her. He said, "You're a really great artist. I wish I could draw." "I bet you can," said Vashti. "Me? No, not me. I can't draw a straight line with a ruler." Vashti smiled. She handed the boy a blank sheet of paper. "Show me." The boy's pencil shook as he drew his line. Vashti stared at the boy's squiggle, and then she said, "Please, sign it." The end. I wonder if one of you, if I might have a volunteer, for one of you to draw a dot. Can you come forward and draw a dot for me? Pick whatever color you'd like. Just draw any old dot, and then sign your name. And while you're doing that, I will let you all know, and you all know, that I have more index cards and more art supplies, and I would love it if any of you would come find me after service. I'll be here. Write your dot or your line and sign your name. Did you sign? Awesome. You signed your name. There's Jackson's dot. Awesome. And my plan is to put them on my office door to celebrate the month of creativity. You're welcome to join in. Thank you, Jackson. Oh, yeah, and anyone who has time now. So for now, let's stand and form the arches and sing the kids on their way to the programs. In our Soul Matters theme groups, participants choose one from a selection of theme-related spiritual exercises. One of the suggested exercises this month asks us to take a picture of an act of creation each day for a week. Even if you don't think of yourself as a particularly creative person, maybe especially if you don't, this exercise can be eye-opening. You start seeing things through different lenses. Creation isn't just about making art. Photos might include a child's block tower, a meal someone prepared, putting an outfit together with matching accessories, writing a thank you note. After I had done this for only a couple of days, I started wondering about including things I might not have before. The sun sinking low, hitting the clouds just so, created a sunset, pinks and oranges. Making coffee is a kind of impressive act of alchemy. Running hot water through coffee grounds, who would have thought? I improvised a calendar hook using a twist tie. That's a small act of creation, right? And there are larger, less material acts of creation. As Leslie's example indicates, people create in the realm of social and environmental justice all the time. Later this month, we will hear from a speaker about an organization that is in the process of being created right now, Greater Victoria Acting Together, GVAT, which combines the powers of multiple interfaith and civic organizations to affect social change in our city. In our meditation today, I invite you to use this time to ponder creation, the act of bringing something new into being. I will offer two questions with quiet space in between. Then we'll remain seated and sing our meditative hymn together, the words for which will be on the screen as well as in your hymnals. Let's breathe in and breathe out. If you feel comfortable doing so, close your eyes. First, take some time, if you wish, to mentally review your recent days, or perhaps a typical day in your life. What acts of creation can you find? Inspired by the range of possibilities, the wide expanse of what counts as creation, take some time to reflect upon this question. What in you longs to be brought into being? In your life, in yourself, what new thing might you nurture into being? blessed be.
The first thing I feel is frustration, followed by helplessness, and then, after that, despair. For months, I've been writing a very important book, and until recently, I believed that things were going pretty smoothly. I even had the audacity to think to myself, yes, this is it. Finally, the book you've been trying to write all these years. I, of all people, should know better than to engage in this sort of wishful thinking. Every project starts off with a kind of honeymoon period. At this stage in the game, I'm full of excitement and inspiration. Writing isn't only enjoyable, it's easy and effortless. But eventually the excitement wears off and I start to sober up. And I look at my work critically for the first time and notice all those glaring errors and omissions. As I keep reading what I've written so far, I start to panic. In the back of my mind, a voice keeps repeating over and over again, "What have you done? What have you done? You're writing the wrong book. Stop it." Creatively speaking, this is my biggest fear, that I've wasted yet more time working on something other than the book I set out to write. By now, this is the third time it's happened to me in as many years, so my response is pretty typical. I become despondent. I start questioning what felt so certain only moments ago. I tell myself, "You've wasted enough time on this thing. Move on." And usually I do. But this time, something's a little bit different. I don't want to waste months recovering from this latest setback. In fact, I don't think I even see them as setbacks anymore. I'm starting to realize that it's all part of the process, that the act of creation includes a healthy dose of destruction as well. Entire pages are deleted, drafts are sent to the recycling bin. Did I waste my time on these? I used to think so, but not anymore. With every failed attempt, I'm starting to realize what I don't want this book to be. That's not a cause for fear. It's a cause for hope. So long as I keep working at it, eventually I know I'll hit the mark.
Creation and fear. What is the relationship between fear and creativity in your life? For some people, a good dose of fear can spark creativity and spur it on. The pressure of an impending deadline can get the adrenaline flowing and move the creative process forward, whether you're preparing an article for publication, a painting for a show, or a dessert for a potluck. Fear can also be fodder for creativity in the way that any deep human emotion can inspire creation. Fear about the state of the world can evoke a sense of urgency that calls one to create organized action. In what situations, if any, does fear spark creativity in you? In what situations, if any, does fear inhibit your creativity? Early on in my ministry, I integrated drawing exercises in the workshops I led. The idea was to open up different ways of thinking, to make the whole thing more fun with color and creativity. Some people loved it. Bring on the colored pencils. Others froze. It took me a little while to realize that the reaction to the array of crayons and markers and blank paper was not excitement, but anxiety. They didn't open up. They shut down. I learned to expand the possibilities with such exercises, sometimes including materials like magazine pictures that you can just cut out and paste, or pipe cleaners or Lego. Often I would just amend the instructions. The point is not to create great art. Just get your ideas down on paper. You can use stick figures or doodles or just create a kind of a idea map with words. Lowering the bar of expectation and encouraging playfulness helped a lot. Sadly, it's a fairly common thing to hear people say things like, I can't draw, or I can't sing. I'm not particularly good at either, but I do both. With singing, in particular, I feel lucky to have been brought up in a home in which singing was done for fun. It didn't really matter whether I was good at it or not. I enjoyed singing with my mom along to the show tunes that she would put on the record player. Yes, I'm that old, record player. I liked singing hymns in church with my childhood congregation and singing along to the radio in the car. I wasn't performing, so whether I was good or not was completely irrelevant. I feel a similar way about kids' art. I love children's drawings, and my love of them has nothing to do with how good they are, whether the drawings really look like the things they represent, or whether they are compositionally strong. I love how every mark on the page is an expression of that unique child's self. I'm intrigued by how their art reflects something in their inner world. I'm moved by the mere fact of creative effort, regardless of the product. It's so sad to me when I encounter adults who stopped drawing or singing because someone along the way made them feel that they weren't good enough. Maybe you are not into drawing or singing, but there's some other way in which fear has inhibited your creativity. Maybe you avoid dancing because you're afraid of looking silly or awkward. Maybe you don't like play acting and charades for the same reason. Fear can inhibit creative endeavors that are just for fun. Fear can be even more daunting when the quality of your creation does matter. When you are preparing for a performance or submitting something for publication, trying out some new approach on an important project. When the thing you are creating will be officially judged in some way. With these higher stakes, the fear can intensify. Fear of rejection, fear of failure, fear of not being good enough. This kind of fear can overshadow, even eclipse, the joy of creating. I have a friend whose son plays the piano. At first, he seemed to really enjoy it, producing recognizable tunes by pushing certain keys in a certain order. It was fun. But as he got older, better, and more serious about his craft, he also got more anxious. He was terribly nervous about recitals, to the point of being physically ill. And even in practice, when he was struggling with a certain section of a piece, he'd play it over and over and over until he was in tears, certain he was going to bomb at the next performance. His fear of failure seems to have squelched his enjoyment of the craft. My friend, his dad, wonders what he can do to help his son recapture the joy of playing music. Fear of failure can make you feel miserable. It can also stop creative effort in its tracks. As my stepfather is fond of saying, if at first you don't succeed, quit. It's kind of a joke, but kind of not. It offers the perfect shield from the fear, embarrassment, and despair of failure. Only do stuff you know that you'll do well. If at first you don't succeed, quit. Of course, we all know, intellectually, if not emotionally, that motto is a horrible strategy for success. Really successful people are people who take risks, who allow themselves to make mistakes and learn from them, who are not derailed by failure, but instead keep on keeping on. Years ago, I learned this difference between perfectionism and a healthy drive to succeed. The person with a healthy drive to succeed will take on challenges, will try and fail and try again. They enjoy the striving. The perfectionist does not enjoy the striving. The perfectionist is motivated by a fear of failure even more than they are motivated by a desire to succeed. Thus, they will avoid taking the risks and challenges that could help them succeed. They can slip into self-defeating behaviors like procrastination. If I wait until the last minute to do this project for school, when I get a B instead of an A, I can tell myself that it wasn't my best effort. The thought of putting forward one's best effort and still not getting the A is just too scary to bear. The spiritual task before the perfectionist, and for many of us, is to embrace failure. I don't even like the sound of that. One of the exercises offered as an option in our Soul Matters program this month is to write a resume of failures. The preamble notes that a Stanford Business School professor recently reported a new trend. Young entrepreneurial job seekers are listing their failures on their resumes. Instead of boasting about their successes and awards, they proudly promote their marketing missteps and startup disasters and what they learned from them. By sharing what they learned and how they used that learning, they display their ability to look at their failures with creative eyes, not as dead ends, but as lessons and brave test runs, end quote. The exercise asks us to make a list of our own life failures and note how each one may have, in the long run, led to something new. Maybe not every failure results in some new discovery like Teflon or penicillin. And maybe not every failure teaches us some incredible life lesson. But at the very least, looking at our own failure resumes can put our mistakes in perspective. We see that even with our stumbles and missteps, our lives went on. I've made lots of mistakes. But there are still things of value in my life, things I appreciate, people I care about, issues that matter to me. Life goes on. Remember my "if at first you don't succeed, quit" stepfather? I once gave him a framed copy of my favorite quotation from Unitarian Ralph Waldo Emerson, which I too had on my desk. Emerson says, "Finish every day and be done with it. You have done what you could. Some blunders and absurdities crept in. Forget them as soon as you can. Tomorrow is a new day. You shall begin it well and serenely, and with too high a spirit to be encumbered with your old nonsense." To nurture creativity, to not let oneself get derailed by fear of failure, requires a kind of light-handed openness. Open heart, open mind, go with the flow, try it out, see what happens. We talked about this as a congregation a few years back, cultivating an experimental mindset, doing what is called beta testing. Trying out things that take up little upfront effort or investment and seeing how they go. If something doesn't work, no worries, we let it go. If it does work, we build on it. A small example, when the worship team received complaints about how loud and harried the sanctuary felt before Sunday services, instead of instituting some big declarative change like, "From now on, the sanctuary will be silent space for 10 minutes before the service," the worship team did some experiments. They had the congregation try out 3 or 4 different quiet centering practices. One Sunday was silence. One Sunday was a labyrinth walk and meditation in a separate room. One Sunday was a quiet choral prelude. The congregation said they liked the choral prelude best, so we experimented with that. First only on Chalice Choir Sundays, then on other Sundays, and occasionally, like today, we've experimented with a lively prelude to call our spirits together in the present moment. Experimental mindset. Seems like a good practice for one's personal life, too, especially when there are so many challenges in life for which solutions are just not obvious. You have a sense that something's kind of off or not quite working well, but you don't know how to fix it. And so you go into experimental mode. Try this, try that. Author Anne Lamott writes, "It's funny. I always imagined when I was a kid that adults had some kind of inner toolbox full of shiny tools. The saw of discernment, the hammer of wisdom, the sandpaper of patience. But then when I grew up, I found that life handed you these rusty old bent tools, friendship, prayer, conscience, honesty, and said, do the best you can with these. They'll have to do. In this uncertain life, armed as we are with imperfect tools, it seems wise to embrace that experimental mindset. Try this, try that. Lean into creativity and lean away from fear." In the book Big Magic, Creative Living Beyond Fear, Elizabeth Gilbert talks about making this deliberate choice to favor creativity over fear. She addresses her fear thus, "Dearest fear, creativity and I are about to go on a road trip together. I understand you will be joining us because you always do. But understand this, creativity and I are the only ones who will be making any decisions along the way. Dude, you are not even allowed to touch the radio. What might happen for you if you let creativity drive your life and sat fear lovingly but firmly in the back seat? Living creatively requires keeping fear of failure in check. It also helps to give yourself open time, space, and activities, a slower way of being, what we often call downtime. This feels intuitively true. It's also backed up by brain science. In an interview with Krista Tippett, Rex Jung, a neuropsychologist who studies creativity, tells us that the notion that the left brain is logical and the right brain is creative is a gross oversimplification. The truth is more complex. Many parts of your brain, left and right, working together, are needed to do creative things. What is true is that the neuroprocess of a brain when it's being creative is slower and more spacious. He says there is a down-regulation of the frontal lobe. Jung says that with academic-type intelligence and knowledge acquisition, more is better. Greater cortical thickness, more neurons, higher connectivity between the neurons, and more biochemicals subservient to those neurons. He says it's like a superhighway, allowing you to get from point A to point B directly and quickly. With creativity and the down regulation of the frontal lobes, it's a slower, more meandering process. It's like taking the side roads, even the dirt roads, to get where you're going. This is what enables a brain to put ideas together in new and creative ways. Both are necessary, the focused mode of knowledge acquisition as well as the meandering mode of creativity. You can't be creative if you have no knowledge, no fodder for your creativity. But you also need that slower-paced, more spacious time, some recess to balance the classroom learning. Jung says that creative people usually know what works for them, meditation, exercise, walking in the woods, taking a long hot shower. What works for you? When I thought of my own downtime, I realized that I don't think my downtime is actually empty enough. I tend to read novels or watch TV. I fill my brain with a story. I probably do this because leaving my mind empty renders it vulnerable to an onslaught of to-do lists and anxiety spirals. So what can I do that will ward off the to-do list, but will also leave enough space for open-minded, open-hearted meandering? I don't do it that often, but knowing that this theme was coming up, I've made more of an effort lately to engage in playful creativity, the kind you do for fun without caring any about the result. It helps to have a kid handy and their toys. In recent weeks, with our 4-year-old son, I have built Lincoln log cabins and Magnaform cars. I've made designs with him on his Light Bright. It's really fun. And played with Play-Doh with him and our friends. None of it was fancy, but it was surprisingly satisfying to, for instance, roll the Play-Doh into a ball or a snake or squeeze a little bit between my fingers to make a pleasing, smooth, solid cube. This kind of crafty play takes just enough of my attention that the to-do lists are held at bay, but the craft doesn't take so much of my attention that I feel anxious or driven. It feels more like downtime. I know many of you are crafty sorts, quilting, knitting, painting, and many of you do other creative things, cook, garden, bake, play music, write. What sorts of creative things work for you in that clearing the mind, meditative kind of way? And if your craft does not in and of itself give you that open space, perhaps your craft takes more serious focus and effort than making cubes of Play-Doh, what does work for you? How do you create that open space that allows your brain to do the slow meandering to make creative connections? Speaking of meandering, where are we with this topic? Let's sum up a little bit. The relationship between fear and creation. Fear can spark creativity. Fear can also inhibit, even prevent creativity. Fear of failure, fear of rejection, fear of not being good enough. We looked at a couple of ways to combat those fears. Embrace failure. Learn to see mistakes as a part of the process. Lean into an experimental mindset. Don't let fear drive the car. Give yourself downtime, mental space to meander and make creative connections. And engage in creative play. Do creative stuff for fun, not for performance. All of these methods are aimed at reducing fear and freeing creativity. It seems to me that they're also just good for the soul. Cultivating that kind of open-hearted, open-minded, go-with-the-flow, try, fail, try again attitude seems like a good way to live, as well as a good way to nurture creativity. In closing, I'd like to call your attention to 3 upcoming opportunities for you to engage in creative acts that could be good for your soul. 1, consider attending the next Creativity Micro Retreat. Anna Isaacs hosts them every 4th Thursday of the month here at church. You can come anytime between 5 and 9 p.m. You bring your craft with you, Lego, doodling, writing, sketching, knitting, whatever. There's a social room where folks can chat while they create, and a quiet room for those who prefer to work together in silence. The next one is January 26th. Details are in your January newsletter. For the writers among you, or anyone with a story to tell, consider signing up for the homily writing workshop, scheduled for Saturday, March 18th, led by Reverend Meg Roberts. Details for that are also in your January newsletter. Lastly, you might want to consider what creative action you are called to take in response to the current state of our world. Maybe you are already involved in the creative act of organizing for change. Maybe you'd like to talk with Leslie and the Social Responsibility Coalition about other efforts that you can support. Maybe you'd like to attend the service on January 29th and learn about the GVAT organization I mentioned earlier. There's an Indigenous Perspectives training that I plan to take on January 25 that GVAT organizers are also attending. Diana Smith is going too. Maybe you'd like to join us. There are lots of possibilities in this realm. Way to embrace the singing, folks. We will close with words from poet Gregory Orr. To be alive, not just the carcass, but the spark. That's crudely put, but if we are not supposed to dance, why all this music?